Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Oz podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press that publishes socially engaged literature. With me, as always, are the other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Chris Momberg and Hans Berger. Today we are going to talk about an interesting trilogy of novellas by the writer Paul Auster. The trilogy is called the New York Trilogy, consisting of three novellas, City of Glass, Ghosts, and The Locked Room, all kind of dealing with, identity seems to be a huge subject that is kind of common to all the stories, as well as, it also seems to be commenting on detective fiction in some way or other. But it wasn't my pick, it was Hans's pick. So I'm going to turn it over to you right now, Hans, to let you start us off where you would like to start us off.
Okay. Yeah, so just a brief recap for listeners who haven't read this recently. Like you mentioned, Patrick, the New York Trilogy is a trilogy of three novellas. The first is called City of Glass. It's about a person who is hired basically sort of as an accidental private detective and follows a person who has recently been released from prison for abusing his son. And the reason he was abusing his son was to try to reach some form of access to kind of a natural language, right? The idea being that he would lock his son in a room without access to any kind of any sort of cultural or linguistic influence, and see if there was some kind of natural language that would arise in the absence of learning. And the main character, Quinn, follows the character Stillman and eventually goes insane, probably. We can talk a bit more later about the meaning of that. So that is the City of Glass. That's the first novella. The second novella, Ghosts, is about a series of people, all of whom have colors for a last name. And the protagonist is a private detective named Blue, who's hired to spy on someone named Black, and essentially realizes at some point that he and Black have basically been hired to spy on each other, and that they're in, we can debate a little bit the meaning later of what the relationship is, but that they have been kind of hired into this loop, and tries to sort of break out of the kind of loop of spying that he and Black have been hired into. And then the final novella, The Locked Room, is written by a protagonist whose childhood friend has recently passed away and left a large chunk of writing, and who becomes the kind of the overseer of the literary estate of his dead friend. Marries the dead friend's wife, becomes a father to the dead friend's son, but then eventually becomes obsessed with trying to understand what really happened to the dead friend, and becomes fairly convinced that the dead friend is alive, and then eventually does find the friend, have a conversation with him. So that's an outline of the plots of each of these books. And the first thing that I wanted to kind of get some thoughts from you guys about is, and there are a lot of different ways that we can go with this, but what the relationship is between these three works, and whether or not they necessarily need to be read together to be fully understood. One thing that is maybe the it might be almost a little too easy as a key to unlocking all this, and in some ways I sort of wish that it weren't there, and I forget it each time I read this. This is the third time that I had read this, and every time I've forgotten it until I read it again. But there's a section near the end of the third novella, The Locked Room, that I read as essentially being kind of a confession that the sort of a metafictional confession that the first two novellas were actually written by the author of that they were written rather by the narrator of The Locked Room, right? That he had written City of Glass and Ghosts as kind of a way of trying to grapple with his own experiences. And that in some sense, part of the reason that those works have to go together is that the first two are only, the first two need to be partly understood as kind of the products of the sort of explorations of the character of the third, right? Structurally, maybe you could, it's a loose comparison, but it reminded me, that reading of it reminds me a little bit of Mulholland Drive, maybe, where, you know, the first half of that movie is, it kind of the fantasy of a character in the second half, and there are a lot of meanings and resonances that you're not going to get unless you understand that the first half of the movie is being created by the main character in the second half.
I kept thinking of Lost Highway while I was reading these novels. So, like, David Lynch was a big, like, I found a lot of thematic similarities between Lynch's Ouvre and these three stories.
Well, I think I'd be interested to hear more about that, actually. We can kind of come back to the interconnection and the metafictional quality, but since the metafictional part of it did strike me as Lynchian, even though this predates most of the work of Lynch, right? This came out in the early 80s, so this was kind of, this was in the ether before Lynch completely found his way of thinking. I don't have any proof that it influenced him, but I think they kind of drew on similar currents in broader thought, right? So what connections were you making to Lost Highway with this?
I have trouble pinpointing it's not narrative circularity, but there are these different forms of circularity that pop up in the three stories. Like you mentioned, the two blue and black who have been hired both to spy on one another, and then later during the conversation that the narrator of The Locked Room has with Fanshawe at the end, Fanshawe says that Quinn was hired to track Fanshawe, but then in the end Fanshawe ended up tracking Quinn. So there are these kind of these relationships that are circular, and Lost Highway has this weird circularity in that we start out with one guy who wakes up to find out that his wife has been murdered, and he doesn't recall it. He says that he didn't do it, but he's eventually convicted and sentenced to death for her murder. And then one night in his cell, he transforms into somebody else, and that somebody else wakes up and has no idea about who he is, why he's in this prison. And then this new guy goes and has these weird adventures with a mobster / porn director guy. And it turns out that the wife who was killed and is acting in the pornos that this new character is kind of coming into contact with. And then the new character switches back to the old character, and yeah, you know, I don't know what it means other than I noticed this kind of these circular relationships going on in both Lynch and these three stories.
And also like mercurial identity, right? Because
definitely.
Especially
in both.
In both, yeah. Like Quinn is, what's his pen name? William Williams? William, it's not William Wallace. That's Braveheart. But he's a former poet.
William Wilson.
William Wilson, thanks. He's a former poet, but he's adopted. Quinn is a former poet who's adopted a pen name that he more or less considers to be a separate person. He infuses William Wilson with a life, and from that life writes these detective novels after the death of his wife and kid. And then he takes on the identity of Paul Auster, not the author of the novellas Paul Auster, but a Paul Auster within the first novella, who is not a detective, but, or there maybe there's two Paul Austers, but he meets a Paul Auster later who is confused when Quinn tells him that he received a call late at night looking for Paul Auster, the detective, and he decided to be Paul Auster, the detective. And Paul Auster, the Paul Auster that Quinn meets is a writer. So there's this weird shiftiness of like identity that kind of feels Lynchian. I'd say like Mulholland Drive, you know, with the way that the kind of the character traits of the two women sort of like veer and switch places between those two halves also kind of feels that way, where we sort of imagine ourselves as other people and become them. And I wanted to kind of like ask a question about Mulholland Drive too, Hans, because you mentioned that the end of the third novella, Locked Room, kind of gave away the game in how the narrator sort of confesses that the first two novellas were him sort of grappling with this. I feel like that's sort of a thing that I almost when I've seen Mulholland Drive a couple times now and I watch it and I feel kind of like I'm being given so much when it's revealed pretty explicitly that the first half of the movie is this fantasy of a character who's a very different person in the reality of the second half of the movie. And it feels almost too pat and simple. And then I watch it and I'm mesmerized by how it's not too pat, not too simple. Like it's actually like, let's just get across this threshold and like play in this next space. And I don't think I've read the New York trilogy enough to get, you know, to really kind of to speak with any authority about this, but you say it gave away the whole game when the narrator of the third novella sort of hints pretty explicitly that the first two novellas are his own writing. But I don't know what to do with it. I guess it doesn't feel like it gives away the game to me, because even though it's sort of like indicating that this relationship exists, similar to Mulholland Drive, by kind of like taking away any question about the nature of that relationship, it feels like you're just sort of invited to step past that and just sort of like start asking questions about what that means and what to do with it. And I feel like I really need to read them again to do that, because I don't know how Patrick you felt, but I didn't know what to do with that information.
I thought it made a lot of sense. Like, I feel like, so there are two major similarities between the first novella and the third novella. And in the first novella, Hans, you said like Daniel Quinn takes on this case to kind of watch the abusive father of Peter Stillman, who has been released from prison. And then, like, he starts to do it, and, you know, you use the term insane, but I think it's better to say that he loses his identity. And, like, he kind of loses himself in, like, the rituals that he has to perform to, like, stay awake during his, like, months long stakeout. And also there's a lot of resonance between that and the Knight of Mirrors in Don Quixote. You know, ultimately the Knight of Mirrors is one of the townspeople that lives in the same town as Don Quixote. And he's ultimately not successful, but the point is to reflect Quixote back at himself, right? To show him, like, he's this old scraggly dude, not a knight. And in City of Glass, that idea is kind of mirrored in the title, City of Glass. So we've got this city, and glass is a reflective surface, but if the entirety of the city is glass, you're going to see all sorts of different reflections of yourself, and they're going to be warped and void and strange, and you're going to lose yourself, which is what I think the character Daniel Quinn does in the first story. Then in the second story, you also have a character losing himself, right? You have the narrator who becomes, like, obsessed with finding Fanshawe. And, you know, even though Fanshawe has said, hey, if you come look for me, I'm going to kill you. But he really starts to kind of lose it, to the point that he has sex with Fanshawe's mother, you know, for whatever reason. Oh my goodness, that was so funny.
Yeah, did he tell his wife? Because, like, him and his wife reconcile, no. and he doesn't tell his wife Sophie about that. Like, your son's grandma and me had a thing.
Fucked.
Yeah,
right. So to answer your question in a long way, I think that it definitely makes sense to me that the narrator would have written at least the first novella as a way to represent his own struggle with losing the identity he believed that he had. You know, he seems to be very, like, when he's with Sophie, he takes on this identity as a loving husband and a loving father. And that seems to be the identity he's most comfortable with. And when he kind of loses track of that, he's less comfortable. So, as I said, it would make sense to me that that would be reflected in the first story. The second story was much more difficult to understand, so I'm not going to quite... Maybe you guys have a comment on that, but... Did I just say everything that needed to be said?
Congratulations, Patrick.
Yeah, you did it, Patrick. You broke it open.
Damn it. It's actually not fun to break it open.
It's not necessarily anyway, fun to break on. It open, which is, you know, I was just going to say, I mean, I think, like, what you said just then is a pretty good way of understanding the mechanics of the trilogy, right? It's a pretty good model for thinking about how the parts all fit together. Once you have that, you can go through and you can start to burrow into individual things. And I'm just trying to think of of all those individual things, what might be more edifying to try to dig at or crack open? One thing that I had it on my mental list of things to talk about, one thing that had struck me a little bit is the intertextuality with Don Quixote, right? How toward the end of the novel, toward the end of the first novella, toward the end of City of Glass, the protagonist, Daniel Quinn, actually reflects on the fact that he shares an initial with Don Quixote and wonders what that means, right? Which is, in a vacuum, almost seems like too much in a way, right? It's like a big flashing sign pointing to something, which has kind of a clumsiness to it. But if you think of City of Glass as being partly a matter of God, it's so confusing trying to keep all these characters straight to discuss them, right? It's one of those books where, what was the book that we read where like there were like 12 characters and five of them were all named of the same thing?
Gilead had a bunch of Johns.
Something like that, yeah. It's even though in many ways this is like you couldn't pick two contemporary-ish novels that are more different than Gilead and this, it does have that quality of how do I keep any of the names of the characters straight, right?
Right.
But anyway, the narrator of...
Does the narrator have a name? Is he just the narrator?
Well, I assume it's Paul Auster. You mean the narrator of The Locked Room?
Yeah.
I think the narrator of The Locked Room... I think we should understand the narrator of The Locked Room as being named Paul Auster. It's never said explicitly, but...
All right, but that does make sense.
And certainly the narrator of City of Glass is named Paul Auster, right? Even though that also has to be inferred a little bit.
Isn't Paul Auster the friend of the narrator?
Yes. I said certainly, and I was wrong. No, you're right. Yeah, Paul Auster.
I believe Paul Auster is the friend of the narrator. So it's so maddening. But yeah, Paul Auster is in City of Glass, and then him and the narrator, who are acquaintances, both investigate the apartment where Quinn has left his journal, and the narrator takes it, not Paul Auster.
So the narrator of the third one is the friend of Paul Auster, assuming that they're the same person.
No, the narrator of the first one is the friend of Paul Auster. But Paul Auster, I'm assuming, is also the narrator of the third one, even though I don't know if I have any real specific things to point to back that up.
The first and the second... I think that the simplest way to think about this is the first and the second novellas are written within the universe of the third novella. So there is no continuity necessary. You know, Paul Auster, you know, the character in City of Glass, has no necessary like contiguous physical relationship with the writer of Locked Room, because the writer of Locked Room pretty explicitly hints at the fact that the first two novellas are his creation while sort of grappling with this experience in his life. So like in a way the game is sort of meaningless, right? Because like the narrators of the first, the complicated narrator sort of relationship of the first novella, like whoever the narrator is in his relationship to Paul Auster, all of that is a game that's sort of ultimately, and I think you were going to say this, Hans, reflective of how Don Quixote is written, right? Like, because basically the frame says, I found this, it's real. And then like that whole, I found this, it's real, is turned on its head by the third novella where the narrator says, oh yeah, I wrote that while dealing with this sort of existential crisis. So I made, you know, the whole I found this, it's real is nonsense, because it's really more of a, almost like a poem, you know, or some other kind of, it's more about an internal landscape than something that actually happened or is even meant to have happened in physical reality. Right? Or is...
That's my understanding. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. One of the questions that I was going to ask was how much the metafictional aspects and the kind of aspects of absurdity undercut the emotional seriousness of the story, or how the emotional seriousness of all the stories, but particularly Locked Room, you know, there's an idea that people have that you'll hear that, I mean, this is kind of the definition, to my understanding, of postmodern metafictional trickery, right? This book is, if you wanted an example of that sort of, the kind of fuckery that is kind of regarded as passé now, I think this is pretty much it. And one of the standard knocks on that is that it gets in the way of telling an emotionally valid story, right? And that it is contrary to emotional engagement, or, you know, corrosive to emotional engagement with the work. And I was going to ask, I mean, obviously that's, I may be kind of strawmanning that argument, right? I may be strawmanning that perspective. But I was just going to, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was how the metafictional aspects and the absurdity do or don't have that effect on the character engagement and the narrative engagement that you have on a subjective level reading these works, or this work.
It got in my way with Ghosts. Because I found, and maybe I read it again and I feel differently, and I'll say Locked Room and City of Glass felt like there were these striking moments and scenes and set pieces, and I think the long interpolated story told by, is it Peter Still? No. What's the name of the son?
Yeah, Peter Stillman, the son.
Yeah, the son.
The son is Peter, yeah. I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. Was really, it was like this interesting, shocking, effective, emotional, like, you know, center, or not a center, but it was something, you know, and actually City of Glass had a couple things like that. And then Ghosts, I didn't have that. And then I got to the end and I felt like the final confrontation between Black and Blue was, their conversation just felt like a parody of a postmodern kind of, like, it was like, this is like what someone writes when they're like, I'm just going to Beckett it up. You know, like, I'm going to have these two people like having a conversation where like nothing is given away. And ultimately, like, the relationship between what they're talking about and like any kind of real conversation is like, let's just sort of like let this, you know, conversation drift away from empirical reality and just like let it happen. Like I really kind of got lost in that novella. I felt like the first and the third ones were really effective for me. And so I want to return and read Ghosts, and I don't want to just sort of like throw a criticism at it either, because like I've only read it the one time, and but you asked if the metafiction got in the way. I guess is it the metafiction, or is it just like the postmodern, like the real like achy postmodernism of it, of Ghosts, just sort of kind of, it just felt like it was, didn't have as much humanity in it. And maybe that was a point of it. I don't know. Like,
yeah, the names were maybe part of that for me, right? The way that every character is named after a different color kind of gives it all the feel of like a writing exercise or a hypothetical or something like that, you know? And the period piece aspect of it is, I'm not sure what's going on with that. Yeah, there's some way that it's just not there. If nothing else, there's an atmosphere that the first and third ones create, right? Particularly the first one that stuck with me for years. And you know, I read this just for fun in maybe like 2010 and really enjoyed it, but couldn't totally make heads or tails of it. And as the years went by, I think more than anything, it wasn't the characters or the events or the themes that stuck with me. It was just the mood and the atmosphere, right? And there's some kind of alchemical way that the first and third stories create this mood of confusion, mystery, menace, kind of longing that the third one doesn't really nail. And I think with the third one...
The middle one.
Yeah, sorry, the middle one. Yeah, the middle one doesn't really nail.
Ghosts.
That Ghosts doesn't really nail. Even the title is kind of like, eh, whatever, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of bland.
Yeah, yeah. It's the kind of title where, like, you know, you think about that title and you just start to, like, make a list of all the books and songs and albums that are just called Ghosts, right? Like there's a right. song by Japan and an album by the Straubs and yada yada. But I'm not sure what it is about Ghosts.
Maybe it's that.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, it's just kind of, it might just be a question of just kind of, it's just one of those mysteries of aesthetics kinds of things.
I have a suggestion. It's not what Ghost, there's another way to get at it, which is what the other two pieces have, which is grief. They're grief stories. I don't think Ghosts, like he Blue leaves his I don't know if they're engaged, but fiance. He basically kind of drifts into this. Ghosts is setting Ghosts aside, just, you know, I don't want to pick on Ghosts. I like the things that make City of Glass. Let's looking at City of Glass first. This grief that is like there, you know, the loss of his wife and kid. And I think it's very well done because it manifests in actually like the motivations of Quinn as well, where, you know, he feels protective of this child that has been abused that he wants to save. It reminded me a little bit of, When We Were Orphans, what's his name?
Ishiguro.
Ishiguro, where the Kazuo Ishiguro, like he loses himself in this quest for his parents that is so personal that like it feels you're buoyed along by this deep compulsion that makes sense because like it makes sense and it's heartbreaking. And I felt that with City of Glass where it's like, he is unmoored. Like he's already unmoored when we meet him, but like, this is like a reason for him to kind of sail out of sight of shore. Like he's like, he has a goal now with this very strange family and this situation that he obviously doesn't understand except that it touches him very deeply and it just basically causes him to like lose himself. And then I think the third story, Locked Room is like another angle, a really kind of beautiful angle where like the grief is not the, it's more presented as almost like this, this like incredible frustration or anger or antipathy. But I felt reading it at least the first time, like it was actually a very affecting story for me about how grief can manifest as antipathy, as hatred, like as like really like toxic resentment for the person who's gone. And and it's not just about that. I think that that, and maybe I'm, that's a misreading on my part, but I felt like the grief of the first and third novellas was a, was something that really made emotional, lent emotional weight to the stories that allowed them to play with our sense of reality. I think that it made the kind of play with identity almost sort of make a kind of an emotional sense too for me. And that's something that I didn't feel in the second novella. It didn't have that for me. And that's what I would say, like, is so beautiful about the first and the third novellas.
So I like everything you just said then, Chris. I thought that was a really good point. And I particularly liked the phrase that you used, sail out of sight of shore, right? Because I think that metaphor captures what all the protagonists in these three stories are doing. And I've been trying to think about what is there in ghosts that is mysterious in isolation, that is illuminated in, that's illuminated in the context of the three works, particularly knowing that Ghosts was written by the narrator of The Locked Room. One thing that I found interesting about Ghosts, or inexplicable about Ghosts, is his relationship to the fiancé, right? Because it's not stated too explicitly, it's not dwelt on, but he basically just cuts off all contact with his fiancé as a corollary of taking this assignment to watch Blue, right? He cuts off that relationship, and it seems like he kind of regrets that he has to, but he just takes it for granted that he does, and he doesn't really give her an explanation. And it's very, if there's any kind of emotional, if there's any hidden emotional core to that work, part of my instinct was to say that in some way it did have to do with that, right? With this mysterious decision to isolate himself from his fiancée for this job that he doesn't seem that enthusiastic about. And, you know, it's not like there's not any way to be in touch with her while he's doing this stake out of Blue. But I think, you know, if both of those, if the first two novellas in the trilogy are the narrator of The Locked Room grappling with the experience he's had, one of the things that he's basically done in The Locked Room is cut himself off from his wife, sail out of sight of shore from his wife, so to speak, for reasons which are to some extent inexplicable or irrational to him, right? And so it makes sense that the character in his work would do that same kind of thing, but maybe in a way that has, maybe in a way that's even more inexplicable, right? If he's dealing with his inexplicable decision to sabotage that relationship for this quest to understand and find and track down Fanshawe, then, you know, it makes sense that a character he is writing would do that in this very sort of reduced way that doesn't have the depth of his, that doesn't have that same kind of depth, right?
But it hints at the depth because, and I agree, I think that that's a good angle on it. And it hints at the depth because Blue watches Black do something that, that the narrator of Locked Room doesn't have the, it, courage is the wrong word, but the self, the awareness to do, which is to really kind of, it's, it seems like what they're seeing is like what Blue is seeing is black, and his partner, his fiance or wife or life partner break it off in a restaurant, right? And it's like very emotional, and it's kind of like, it's like the one fragment that feels something like kind of like a connection back to, you know, like the grief in City of Glass, that scene between Black and his I don't want to say his woman, but I guess like his woman in that restaurant, where they break, they have like a kind of a fight. They're both distraught. And so I like what you say about like, it turns it almost into a way for the narrator of Locked Room to attack himself, right? Where it's like, this is as much sense as what I did makes, you know, like, leaving Sophie, and this is, and like, this is how distant and how much, I don't know. There's a way that adding that scene, adding that, adding Blue seeing heartbreak from the outside makes that work and feel, pretty interesting. I'll give that to you. That didn't occur to me.
I feel like we probably can't do this podcast without at least briefly addressing the ways that this relates to the classic detective novel, because that is so much of how it's thought about and talked about, to the extent that it's remembered much or discussed today, right? Is as a postmodern twist on the detective novel, right? Did you guys have any thoughts about how he's using the ideas or conventions of the form, or how it's working as either an example or a critique of genre?
I really don't know enough about like detective fiction to say much about it. Like, he does mention, you know, the Poe character, Dupin, the guy in The Murders of the Rue Morgue and The Purloined Letter, like, but I don't, you know, I know Poe, like, created detective fiction, or, you know, then later Sir Arthur Conan Doyle kind of took Poe's ideas and created Sherlock Holmes and whatnot. But other than that, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't. I think like there's the most interested or touched I was by it was when Quinn starts adopting the kind of clipped language, the repartee of what he imagines a detective should sound like, and how a detective should act when dealing with the wife, Peter Stillman's wife. I don't remember her name. And he's thinking consciously of like, oh, this is when I should, you know, sort of say something that's kind of pithy, or, you know, like, and I don't know, it's not something that comes out like quite so clear as that, but like there's this awareness of the form that of like detective storytelling that is sort of guiding his behavior as a as a sort of unwitting character in a story that is aware of itself as a story, where he's like, I'm going to behave this way.
But overall, yeah, to my mind, like I definitely see what you're saying, Chris. Like he takes on the mannerisms of what he thinks a detective is, But overall, the effect seems to me to just be to, like, undercut detective fiction. You know, if detective fiction is characterized by singular geniuses like Sherlock Holmes or Dupin, that can't be how you pronounce his name, then these stories are characterized by people who have no idea what's going on. And, like, either there's no real mystery or the mystery is never resolved in any of these stories. Whereas in detective fiction, if the mystery is not resolved, you know, you're going to have some seriously pissed off old ladies. Right?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess if anything, if the whole kind of, if the awareness of the conventions of detective fiction or the cultural idea of the detective serve any function narratively, it's there's something that people can kind of hang their pre-existing urge for self-destruction on, right? Quinn, like you guys have mentioned a couple times, Quinn is naturally moving towards self-erasure. And at the time that he meets the Stillmans, he's already in this semi-conscious way rubbing himself out of existence. And if Quinn already has the urge towards self-erasure, then the cultural idea of the detective is something that he can dissolve himself into, right? And, you know, he does that in the way that he pours himself into that is part of the process of wiping out his own identity that you guys have already seized on, right? So, you know, you have this character in the locked room who is embarking on this quixotic, absurd kind of quest. And one of the ways that he understands that when he's trying to grapple with it is to take that and kind of push it, to take that urge and push it into the form and conventions of the cultural idea of a detective, right? Which might be part of why Ghosts is a period piece, because we just kind of have this idea that, you know, the detectives and the 40s go naturally together.
Right.
I had a question, a little bit of a change, Hans, if you don't mind. Maybe I had a question about Fanshawe. Like, what is Fanshawe, just a device, or is Fanshawe also kind of meant to be sort of appreciated or read into, you know, because we spend very little time with actually Fanshawe, but he motivates conceivably the whole thing. And he's interesting in that he seems like this incredibly, you know, you mentioned the incapability of these detectives, Patrick. Fanshawe seems incredibly capable. Mm. Like he's almost a kind of a mastermind, it right. seems, at time.
Right, absolutely, yeah.
Well, like, what is he, and what are we supposed to do with him? Are we supposed to think of him just as the motivator, as the inciting event, or is he something to kind of study?
I wonder if he even exists. Like, he clearly exists in the narrator's mind, but I don't know. I kept feeling like at the end we were gonna find out that the narrator was Fanshawe himself. I don't know.
I had that thought too, but I read the meeting as, I guess I read as it straight, real. But I, you know, I don't know, Hans. You're the Fanshawe of the group. Tell us what's real.
I mean,
that's hilarious.
I do think that Fanshawe really exists within the realm of, to the extent that there is an underlying reality in this trilogy, I do think that Fanshawe exists, right? Because if Fanshawe doesn't exist, then, you know, is Sophie a hallucination? Are his conversations with Sophie about Fanshawe a hallucination? Is, you know, does he fuck his own mother, right? I totally understand why you might drift in that direction, given the general play of identity that the novel has, right? I get why you might think, oh, there's like a secret Fight Club ending buried there, right?
Mm.
But I don't know that it's thematically necessary, right? I mean, and maybe if you guys pursue it a bit, if you push it a bit more, it might be something you could convert me to. But my sense of it is more that ultimately Fanshawe is unknowable, right? He almost kind of, and if he represents anything, I think it might kind of be like inscrutability, unknowability, right? The kind of vacuum at the center of the universe that you guys talked about when you did Moby Dick all those years now ago, right? And it's very telling, I think, that at the very end of The Locked Room, the narrator gets Fanshawe's notebook, right? And the notebook is supposed to reveal all the answers that he's wanted for all this time about, you know, why did Fanshawe leave his wife? Why did Fanshawe vanish? Like, what is his thing, you know? And he reads it and he says, oh, well, it just all cancels itself out. It doesn't make any sense. And he never tells us about anything that's in it. And he rips it up and that's that, right? And I mean, I think that if you guys are right, I think that Fanshawe is not particularly developed as a character, right? He kind of exists more as an ideal than a person. But I think that he has to, because if the narrator of The Locked Room were in fact able to reach a true understanding of Fanshawe, were able to see him as a fully fledged person, if he were able to fill that in, then he wouldn't be compelled to write the first two books to try to come to terms with that mystery, right?
Yeah, I think it's more interesting for me to see him as Fanshawe as a character. And I don't like to, I don't want to just simply reduce Fanshawe down to like being like a symbol for something necessarily, but it did strike me as being sort of poignant at the end when he doesn't appreciate his own work that he's created. He obviously does not have the relationship to Sophie that Sophie thought she had to him. And there's something about how his capability, his like, it seems seemingly bottomless ability to just sort of excel at whatever he did, was offset or mirrored by a kind of a lack of appreciation or a lack of connection to the things that he was responsible for and the people that he had relationships with. And I don't know exactly where to take it. It feels like it feels too easy to kind of like pivot that into some sort of like pithy or simple statement about how like the people who have it easy just don't appreciate what they got. But like there's something about how that I think offsets the kind of struggle that the narrator of Locked Room has for basically feeling like he's in Fanshawe's shadow and missing Fanshawe. And I was reading Locked Room and just dreading that it was going to be pivoting towards some sort of like Twilight Zone, like ending when, or Fight Club, because it felt so real to me and so effective as a story about grief and really nuanced. And maybe what I was enjoying a lot about it was something that I was applying to it in order to enjoy it more. But the, you know, I really appreciated how the narrator suffering in Fanshawe's shadow and comes to the end and realizes that Fanshawe is like his own, he has his own form of suffering that is way worse. But I don't know, maybe that's too fairy tale ending, but it resonated with me. I think it sank the hook pretty well and made it feel as though, like, I wanted in the end to kind of like root for the narrator, even though like he had, one, married his best friend's, gal, two, started sort of like basically absorbing his best friend's, like, his former best friend's like successes in life. And then three, screwed his best friend's mom. So, you know, like I was like, oh, you know, like despite all of these things, he's actually like a decent human being. And Fanshawe isn't. Like, Fanshawe's a loser. He ran away from his kid and his wife, and he can't appreciate the beauty that he participates in because it feels, for whatever reason, he can't. So I appreciated that about that ending. Mm. And I wanted to read him as a character for that reason.
Well, that seems like a pretty good way to wrap everything up, actually. I think that ties a lot of the ideas that we've been talking about thematically together. And I really, you know, I always enjoy talking to you guys about books, but I really want to thank you both. I mean, I like I mentioned, I first read this probably 11 years ago, and I don't know that I've really felt like I ever came to terms with it until now. So you guys both had some really cool insights on it that I really appreciate.
Yeah.
What's the choice, Patrick? It's your turn, right?
Yeah. So my pick for next time is Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. You guys read it?
No.
Did you read it, Hans? Have you read it?
No.
No. Okay. Well, we'll see. I haven't read it either. It's been on my list to read for a long time. But wait, there's a surprise. It's a good surprise. You guys want to know what the surprise is? The surprise is we are going to be joined on the next podcast by renowned Korean-American poet Edward Kim.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Awesome.
So that'll be fun. I told him about a week and a half ago what my pick was, so, because he said he needed to know because he's a slow reader, he said. So, yeah, he's going to join us. But so that's the deal. We're gonna be joined by Eddie Kim and talk about Invisible Man.
Sounds good. All right.
Cool.
Always a pleasure, guys.
Yeah, always awesome talking to you, and check you guys later. Peace out, everyone.